Trust Business Lunch. This is John Williams. Hi, Pete Zimmerman's the producer. We appreciate you dialing in. We're here weekdays from noon until 1 o'clock. Anna DeVlantis will join you after 1 o'clock. Let's start our show today, as we often do, with John Najarian. We'll talk about the markets. We'll also talk about a stimulus package, or a not-stimulus package. Hey, John, you're on. How are you?
I am doing very well. Thank you, John.
I saw a headline today, NASDAQ hits fresh record highs. It's funny because the NASDAQ and the Dow get all the attention. If we had to pick one of the indexes, though, indices, would it be the Dow, the NASDAQ, or the S&P? If you had to pay attention to one, which one you think I should focus on?
Well, I would focus on the NASDAQ, and the reason for that is the tech stocks. Because they flourish and, of course, outperformed like crazy during the lockdown. And they dialed forward not just demand, in which case that would mean they have some flat performance due ahead of them, but they also got new adopters to come into these technologies. And many of us that we were just talking about this on the halftime, I love Zoom. I use it all the time. I do not use it when I need to do something secure for work. When I need to use something secure for work, I use Microsoft Teams. And I think many of the institutional players do. So when I say adopters, there were probably a relatively small number of folks that were using anything other than WebEx prior to Zoom really exploding onto the scene. There was, you know, a GoToMeeting, and there was WebEx, which is a Cisco product. And all of a sudden, Zoom made it really easy. They exploded. The stock price moved up by 500%, actually 600% at the highs, but now is coming back to earth, and I think it'll keep coming back to earth because, again, paying customers at the likes of Fortune 1000 companies are going to be using something like a secure product, Microsoft Teams, rather than Zoom, even though Zoom is great. But I think that valuation then comes in somewhat dramatically, John. So if I had to pick, that's a long-winded explanation, but if I had to pick, I'd stick with technology. Secondarily, I'd say S&P 500. And lastly, I'd say IWM or Russell. I'd never say the Dow, because the Dow isn't indicative of anything anymore, the way they've sort of bastardized that index.
I suppose, as goes the Dow, at least so go the other indices. They aren't always fighting each other, and we sort of know the Dow better than we do, but I'm not surprised to hear you devalue its importance. I thought I was setting you up for the S&P, though, because if I were concerned about my retirement, more of that is probably covered by the S&P, right?
Yes, and it's a steady, even though it is moved, or the movement of it is controlled a lot by those very tech stocks we talked about, it does give you that diversification outside of technology that the NASDAQ just doesn't. I mean, effectively, the NASDAQ itself, 40% of it is made up of those top five names that we always talk about. And the rest of it, even if some of them are in energy and some of them are in various types of mining and so forth, it's not really as much of a mirror of your retirement account so typically that Americans would have.
Is there a stock or sector that's caught your eye today or this week?
Well, let's see. I liked and I bought today, full disclosure, Under Armour. The reason I bought it was Steph Curry. Steph Curry was signed by Under Armour not only as an athlete and an influencer, but now they're going to have a specific Michael Jordan-esque Jumpman division, sort of like with Yeezys with Adidas and Michael Jordan with Nike. You're going to see this, I think, become a bigger part of Under Armour. And I think Steph Curry still has many good years ahead of him. So I would say this is enough to lift the stock over the next 6 months back towards 20 from about the 1450 range that it was in prior to that.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because if you, to me, Michael Jordan is so singular that it, maybe a LeBron James approaches it. You can get in an argument about who's the greatest of all time, but I don't think anybody will be as great a marketing vehicle as Michael Jordan was. I don't see Steph Curry as on par with that.
I don't either. But on the other hand, of course, Michael Jordan, other than wearing the shoes, didn't have that much to do with it. It was his personality, which is, you know, bigger than any of those other two, including LeBron. And obviously, they were doing this, making that move at a time when Nike was the only firm that was really pushing as hard as they were with an influencer like a Michael Jordan. Now everybody does it to some extent, especially for soccer. And again, it's Adidas or Adidas, depending which pronunciation you like best, John. But I think overall, this is going to be something that moves. This is truly a small cap stock too. Under Armour is not a Nike.
I mean, really?
It takes a lot to move Nike, but for Under Armour, symbol UA, it doesn't take nearly as much to move Under Armour as it does to move Nike. It's a $7 billion market cap in the case of Under Armour, and Nike is just this global behemoth that Under Armour hopes to grow into someday, but Nike's $212 billion. So it gives you an idea that it doesn't have to be that he's the next Michael Jordan. He just has to be something that gets that stock to move.
Those are interesting numbers, 9 versus 212. By the way, is Adidas the European pronunciation? Is that how they say it over there?
Yeah, my German friends, and it's a German company, pronounce it Adidas, not Adidas.
I guess, who are we to tell them they're doing it wrong, but it sounds not right.
Yeah, that's what everybody always tells me, but I still pronounce it that way.
What are you making of stimulus tug of war? Where are we? How are you handicapping that one?
Well, thank God it's out of Pelosi's hands, because I think she totally screwed it up. They should have agreed to something around $1 billion back in August, and I think they could have. But this was something that was planned to hurt the president. And it worked, but it hurt tens of millions of Americans as well. Now they're basically talking about a $900 or so billion bill, which is exactly what was on the table back in August when she wanted $3.4 trillion. And I think they could get a deal done in that $500 to $900 billion range, and the sooner they do it, the better, because with the coronavirus outbreak, this is something that's impacting businesses and those workers at those businesses. And if you don't want those workers to basically just hunker down and not go out and not spend, which hurts all of us, you've got to give them a hand, you know, a bridge, if you will, to that other side when the vaccines start arriving.
Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have unveiled today a stimulus package, which is roughly what you're describing, about $1 trillion, including $288 billion in payroll protection program, stuff like that. So we'll continue to follow that.
Let's hope they get it through, John.
John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news, education, and subscription site, MarketRebellion.com. Well done, John. Nice to talk to you. You stay well.
Always well done by you, John. Thank you.
That's nice of him to say. I just asked the questions. By the way, just one other note. We were just talking with John Najarian about the stimulus package, and he was hopeful that this compromise bill, which Mark Warner calls an interim bill, the Virginia senator, Mark Warner said this is an interim package until Joe Biden becomes president in January. It would put $16 billion into vaccine distribution, testing, and contact tracing, and put funds into rental assistance and child care and broadband. The proposal, this smaller bill, $900 billion, would not include another direct payment to most Americans. There's almost $300 billion in paycheck protection. That's for small businesses. but it would not be a $1,200 check in the mail for you. The programs lapsing at the end of December include unemployment insurance extensions, federal student loan payment moratorium, and some protections from eviction. Nancy Pelosi still wants the big $2.2 trillion version. Mitch McConnell still wants something more like a half a billion. They're both dug in on that, and that's where we are today. Laura Pratt joins us. It's actually La Pratt, and she's the owner of Shopping Girl XOXO. ShoppingGirlXOXO.com is the website. Laura, you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Tell me how your business is doing. Tell me what you do.
Yeah, so I am a personal stylist. I started my business over 12 years ago now, and I help women to not only look, but most importantly, feel confident in their own skin through fashion. So I go into women's wardrobes and help them to purge what doesn't make them feel good and put outfits together from what they already have and creating head-to-toe looks. And then I really pride my business on supporting local designers and local boutiques. So then I'll pull lots of fun stuff from all over the city and either bring it to your home or to my showroom. And you can come and we'll just have a fun day of pampering and helping you to feel really great in your wardrobe.
Sounds like something that requires personal contact. So when did when the pandemic hit, how did that impact you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone, I mean, the word of the year is pivot, but I think everyone just had to pivot their business. So I've been able to really tweak things and make virtual options available. And, you know, it took a little bit of a learning curve, but I have really nailed down virtual options, and it's so much fun. I just box up lots of fun stuff and either do door-to-door drop-offs, or I've now actually been shipping across the country tons of stuff, and then we do Zoom or FaceTime styling sessions, and you can purchase as much as you'd like, ship everything back to me, and I take care of the returns. So, yeah, there's lots of fun virtual options out there now, and I know it really affected all of the local businesses that I work with as well, but everyone just had to kind of go virtual. So there's a lot more online shopping available now, and it's so much easier to support those local businesses than it was before, because we all had to pivot.
I think the consumers have as well, too, right? That is, we've all learned to live in a Zoom world, so where perhaps I might have been a little resistant to this format, now maybe people are more willing to embrace it, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and people, all of the business owners, you know, have just gotten creative. So there's so many fun new options out there for people. Whereas before, if you were an online shopper, you just had to go to those big box stores. And now you can have those personal experiences still that you used to have with local boutiques and local designers and personal stylists.
But how are you able to, how do you know what my style is? How would you know what works for me?
Yeah, so I absolutely pride my business on getting to know my clients on a personal level and bringing out their own unique style. So I definitely go through a very fun consultation where I ask lots of crazy questions that really dive deep into whether it's what your style is or what you want your style to be before I start shopping all over the city for you.
And I guess I hold my phone up or my laptop up to my closet and walk you through my shoes, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So, well, before our initial wardrobe analysis or styling session, I ask lots of fun questions. We do it through Zoom. You can, you know, show me, or I just have people send me pictures. I think it's really important to know body shapes and coloring before I do polls. So, you know, some people are more comfortable just sending me a headshot and like a full body shot so that I can get an idea that way as well. Everyone's on social media these days too, so people can easily just send me links to lots of photos or there's
Pinterest.
That's
right.
There.
Yeah, between Instagram and Facebook, I've already done my wardrobe for you. It's right there. You can probably get a sense of somebody's personality. We're talking to Laura LaPrette, and her business is Shopping Girl XOXO. So business is still up and going for you. And I also understand, well, with it being Giving Tuesday, you're actually donating 10% of the purchase price for your service to a charity through the end of the year, right?
Yes, I'm so excited. Actually, today only for Giving Tuesday, I'm actually donating 20% of all online sales to Hope for the Day. So Hope for the Day is an organization that's very near and dear to my heart, and especially around the holidays. I think it's so important. They are a mental health awareness and suicide prevention organization. And, you know, the holidays are obviously all about joy and fun, but they're also extremely hard for some people. So I think it's really important to consider that. So 20% of the sales today are going to Hope for the Day. And then, yes, through the end of the year, 10% of the sales will still be going to Hope for the Day. And we have all of our gift certificates are available online. So if you purchase any Shopping Girl gift certificates today, 20% will go to Hope for the Day, which makes it an even extra special gift for somebody.
When I buy your service, I'm buying your service. And then I'm also, say you pull clothes or shoes or whatever that I like, and I go, oh, good, I'm going to get these. Then that's obviously a different transaction, right? So you're, how does that work? Do you pay for the clothes and then ship them and return them, and I'll pay for and keep what I want?
Yep, pretty much. I have built over the years such close relationships with these companies and small businesses and even the big box stores, if I need to pull from them, but they loan the clothing to me. So I'm, giving them to my clients to try. And then when I return the clothes, I pay for what's sold.
Got it. Do people sometimes send the clothes back to you and they have mustard stains on them?
Then, unfortunately, you do have to pay for that. Yes.
Because the big box stores know about that. People say, listen, this dress, it didn't work out. I don't like it. It didn't fit. And you can tell that they've used it. I don't know if that still happens, but I know that used to happen.
Yeah, hopefully, definitely with my clients, it does not happen, but you never know. That's a little trickier with those big box stores, too. That's another thing with the small businesses. It's such a personal relationship that I have with all of the owners, and it's just very open and easy to discuss what's going on all ends, and yeah, built on trust over the years, so.
Laura LaPrade is the owner of Shopping Girl XOXO, so that's the site, Shopping Girl XOXO. So if you want some consultation service and, I guess, trendy clothes, but also what a timely and thoughtful charity that you're giving to, too. Well done, Laura. I wish you nothing but luck.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful talking to you.
Likewise. Shopping Girl, XOXO, Laura LaPrade. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Wintrust Business Lunch continues now at 12:34. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. This is John Williams. Up next, Dale Buss, author, journalist, founder of the Flyover Coalition. The website for his organization is flyovercoalition.org. Dale, welcome back to WGN.
Thanks, John.
Let's talk a little bit about the reset. I suppose that's still sort of going on, right? Not only do I not have to work in the office, I don't have to work in the city I've been working in either. What are you hearing about how businesses are sort of resetting their employees?
Well, actually, you're right. I think it's just begun in terms of kind of a fundamental shift in American business in lots of ways. It may not play out exactly as people have been talking about, but I cover all of this in the cover story for the 2021 Site Selection Guide for Chief Executive Magazine that's due out next month. And what I found from talking to dozens of CEOs and economic development consultants and other people is that this geographic reset as companies react and follow up on the differences that COVID has made in their, you know, companies and in the economy, it's taking on several dimensions. You mentioned a couple. There's obviously clearly this migration from the traditional office to some kind of what people think will be a hybrid model. You know, everybody seems to be tired of working all week away from the office, perhaps, and maybe with their kids underfoot because they're not in school. But what the CEOs I talk to are telling me is that what we're going to emerge with sometime next year is kind of a hybrid model in very, very many places where people may come into the office for a day or two, not the whole week. They may not have an assigned space. There may be, you know, digital scheduling, kind of like an open table for office cubicles like we have for restaurants. And that's going to be one of the major dynamics. And then the other one I think you mentioned is cities versus suburbs is another huge dynamic. And clearly what we're seeing from this real estate boom in suburbs, you know, across America is the beginnings of a definite long-term retreat from that core central city. And what people I talked to said, look, a lot of millennials are like, okay, the city was great, but now I've got young kids. I see dangers in the city, maybe. I see the virtues of the suburbs that I didn't used to. You know, I think that's kind of where I'm headed.
Or maybe even the exurbs. There's a great quote in your piece, and it's something along the lines of, the novelty of working from home wore off in about July. And I can get that, right?
Yeah.
March, April, May, we started to migrate home. May, June, July, hey, this is pretty fun. I don't have to go into the office and wear a tie. But by July, you're sharing a space. Maybe your kids have been doing some at-home learning or about to go again, and you needed to get out. I've also heard people say the open floor plan does not lend itself, and a lot of people have been loving the open floor plan as a living space. It's not a good place to work with the family. So I can just see how people are itching to either get back to an office or get back to an office a few times a week, which is what we're doing here, by the way, Dale. At least one of our departments at WGN Radio doesn't come in all at once, but they're rotating through to get work done here.
Well, I think that what's happened is this is happening along a couple of rails. One of them is technology. So what's happened is a lot of companies, including the CEOs, are saying, you know what, this technologically, this worked pretty well. You know, we can Zoom instead of fly six executives to some store in Montana. Saves us a lot of money and time. But the other rail that's developing is culturally. Does that really work for most companies to have people completely dispersed and in those kinds of circumstances in homes that you mentioned, not together, not pinging off each other with ideas, creativity, relationships? You know, a lot of companies are saying that does not work for us long term. And another factor is a lot of companies have spent a lot of money in the last decade trying to make their offices and even factories, just workplaces in general, places that compel people to come to want to work, you know, with the labor shortage, especially in the millennial generation and with Gen Zers. And they don't want to abandon all this. And I think a lot of business people are finding, you know what, this is a place we need to try to get back to. Hopefully within the next year they'll be able to. And I've talked to some people for the chief executive story who said that they think that maybe 80 to 90% of what used to be in the office will still come back there in some form.
There's some ping pong paddles out there that are not being used right now. And I'm thinking about the
That's businesses that have made
very friendly open workspaces. There's probably a sushi chef somewhere who would love to get back to Google. You know,
yeah, or a pet massager, or, you know,
to work in one of those places. I saw a thing today, I think it was on Channel 9 here in Chicago, and it was about, it was a story about what Hawaii is doing. Hawaii is saying, hey, you don't have to work in New Jersey or Chicago. You can work from Hawaii anymore, live in Hawaii. There's all kinds of advantages. It's an expensive city, but if you can work from anywhere, why not work from Hawaii? I don't know that that's a real practical solution for people, but
yeah,
it's an idea.
Maybe for some people. Well, here's something, too, that I just saw the other day in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. The same kind of effect is occurring in rural Minnesota, where people are saying, you know what, maybe I'll get a cottage on a lake up there, a vacation home, a second home, someplace that I can work much of the time. And so you'll find a lot of places, including Michigan, where I live, the second home, the cottage, the vacation condo market is doing really well. And there's another dynamic to this, too, which kind of is hinted at by what the Flyover Coalition is all about, which is something we've talked about before. To what extent can flyover country gain, you know, places like Illinois and Michigan and Indiana and Arkansas, can we gain from the pain that they're obviously feeling on the coasts? And you've got, in my story, I quote a well-known demographer, Joel Kotkin, who does a lot of work on the business economy. And he says that, you know, large heartland metropolitan areas like Nashville, Austin, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Dallas are all gaining this educated millennial cohort far more rapidly than the traditional coastal magnets like New York and L.A. and even San Francisco. So this dynamic is only really started to make itself felt, and you can just kind of see in your mind's eye some discussions occurring around kitchen tables, you know, in some of these coastal cities saying, you know, I grew up in Missouri, kind of a great place, housing is cheaper, I can work there, I don't have to be in Manhattan. I mean, multiply those kinds of conversations by the thousands, and I think you've got the start of something that could be significant.
Dale Buss is the founder of this Flyover Coalition. I wonder if legislators in the Midwest are listening to this, because Illinois is considering higher taxes, and how do we dig ourselves out of this morass? I think Illinois is a great place to live. I certainly think Chicago is. I'm not sure, though, that people looking from the outside in think, oh, good, let's go there. And I think it puts all the more pressure on us to get our house in order because this is an opportune time. People are looking.
Well, it is, and Illinoisans have said, hey, you know, this, we're not going to pay higher taxes forever. We have a limit. So maybe out of that, develop some kind of opportunity for taking advantage of this. Certainly, if not legislators, at least economic development people in cities all over the heartland are paying attention, are trying to develop ways to pitch people coming from the coast. I talked to somebody in the Tucson area, the economic development people there, and they're trying to come up with incentives for companies to place remote workers, or companies whose workers end up in the Tucson area could get a benefit, a financial benefit, from the fact that their people, you know, while remote from the office, are living and working in Tucson. And they're thinking about trying to set up daycare centers in Tucson to, you know, sort of take care of however this whole school situation resolves itself. So definitely people who are savvy about this are talking about it and trying to figure out what to do.
Reminds me of how cities compete for football teams. Now we're competing for employees. Well, how about this? Well, how about that? We'll make this more attractive for you. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You can read more along these lines. Dale's topic is the cover story for the 2021 site selection guide for Chief Executive Magazine. And he champions that cause over and over again. Flyovercoalition.org. Visit flyovercoalition.org. Dale, nice to talk to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
It's 12:43. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's head back into the WGN Radio newsroom with the latest. Here's some more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Gogo, the in-flight internet company, has completed the sale of its commercial aviation business to a subsidiary of the Intelsat company for $400 million in cash. Gogo will continue as a publicly traded company and focus on the business aviation market. The company says proceeds from the transactions will slightly strengthen Gogo's financial position by reducing its net debt and will allow the company to invest in growth opportunities, including Gogo 5G. Sephora will be replacing all cosmetic areas at Kohl's with 2,500 square foot shops, starting with 200 locations late next year. It'll expand to nearly 850 stores by 2023. The Sephora's online beauty experience will launch on Kohl's.com in the fall of 2021. The deal appears to upend Sephora's 14-year exclusive relationship with JCPenney, which filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in May. Chicago tech and startup companies raised at least $30 million in venture capital funding during the month of November. That's according to data compiled by Chicago Inno. November's fundings were led by Upfront Healthcare, which raised $11.5 million, and NestEgg, which raised $7 million. Local VC activity in November was significantly down from October, when Chicago startups raised about $208 million. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch on Giving Tuesday. How was Cyber Monday? Have you been keeping score on that, Amy?
Yeah, I have. It broke some records. I was keeping an eye on yesterday. You know, mostly, as I told you yesterday, I was waiting to see if any companies had any infrastructure problems, some websites or, you know, vanishing carts, things like that. It doesn't seem like anything, you know, huge happened. There were no big outages. I think a lot of people kind of felt like yesterday was a big test of infrastructure, digital infrastructure for e-commerce, you know, to really test the holiday season. But the total came in at just under 11 billion online. So that's the Cyber Monday total for now. Purchases, I thought this was a really interesting number. Purchases totaled $12 million per minute between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific time. That is a ton of money per minute. So a lot of people at the end of the day were doing that shopping, and, you know, really, really, looking at those sales, doing that kind of thing. Curbside pickup was up about 30% since last year. You know, we forget it was a thing last year. You know, it seems like it was just a thing we invented this year, but curbside pickup did exist last year. Just not many people used it. But yeah, that's a pretty big number. So it certainly broke records. It was the biggest online shopping day in U.S. history, which is pretty significant.
Well, I hope that makes up a difference, right? I wonder if that will be enough to get retailers over the hump, or how that replaces what they would have otherwise done.
Yeah, and I think the big thing everyone's kind of looking at now is that December 11th is historically when shipping starts to really go through the roof because people are, oh gosh, the holidays are right around the corner. I better get things in the mail. So from December 11th through Christmas Day, you know, that's when we see that big push for shipping. But the shipping companies, FedEx and UPS leadership, for example, really saying, hey, please mail this early. We're already really taxed this year. So I think the second half of December is what a lot of people are looking at to see if that's the piece of infrastructure that, maybe can, you know, hopefully withstand the pressure of a lot of people shipping.
Are people giving more today or less? I guess we'll find out, huh?
Yeah, we will find out. I've seen a lot of brands coming out with Giving Tuesday campaigns and various hashtags. Last year, that raised $2 billion just in the U.S., and historically, nonprofits raise the bulk of their money in that final quarter, in that last couple months of the year, but specifically in December, that year-end giving campaign. I'm sure all of us, you know, if you're on a mailing list, you've already started getting appeals in the mail for everything, you know, all kind of different lists that we're all on. But then this year, we have to factor in a lot of economic uncertainty. We have very high jobless numbers. We have, you know, different issues. However, what we have seen this year is people giving to various COVID relief type organizations. And that's not necessarily straight around healthcare, but that's about, you know, making sure people have enough to eat. We've seen the Greater Food the Food Depository of Chicago has certainly said, hey, in these times, we need to feed more people than ever because a lot of people are out of work. So we have seen an increase in that. So I think it'd be interesting to see if that correlates to Giving Tuesday, if we see people really supporting organizations based on personal preference, or if they're really a lot more oriented to economic issues due to COVID.
One last thing, though, speaking of COVID, so the state of Illinois is trying to free up or attract lab space. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Governor Pritzker has announced a grant. It's $9 million in grants to help developers build out facilities to try to attract bioscience companies. The issue with that here and anywhere really is that if you're a real estate developer and you build a lab, that's a very specific space, kind of space that you've done, because they have to have special kind of ventilation and a lot of other sort of things that, let's say, a retail space would need. So if you build a lab space and then in a few years they don't renew their lease and you need to put like a retailer in there, that's a very expensive overhaul for you, the landlord. So we tend to not have a lot of that here. Even though our universities are doing a lot of biosciences work, usually once they get funding, they go to one of those more developed areas like like San Francisco and the Bay Area, like Boston. They, you know, tend to go there once they're funded. So Governor Pritzker is trying to keep those companies here, and he's specifically looking at very early startup companies. So rather than a really established company to help them be here, they're trying to help bring in kind of a multi-use developer that could bring in, you know, hubs of various incubator kind of life science companies to try to attract more of that talent to stay here and more investment to be here, as well as deepen those relationships with the University of Chicago and Northwestern that is already doing a lot of work in that area. So we will see. They believe they can fund probably about four with that $9 million. And the applications are due by the end of January, so we'll see where that shakes out.
Sounds like a good idea, good space for us to be. Let's take advantage of that. Amy Guth reporting on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for your time, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.